Today on Against the Grain. The wines of Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand are widely consumed around the world, especially in the UK, the heart of the former British Empire. And that's no coincidence. The British Imperial Project was central to the cultivation and distribution of wine from its colonies, for reasons both ideological and economic. Historian Jennifer Regan Lefebvre discusses three centuries of imperial wine production and consumption, once primarily reserved for the elite, then later consumed by their lower classes. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. At its height, the sun never set on the British Empire, as the saying goes. And in the sunshine of its colonial possessions, settlers from the British Empire cultivated wine on lands dispossessed from their inhabitants, often with coerced labor. Grapes were grown for wine in Cyprus, Malta, India, and Canada, and especially in South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. Jennifer Regan Lefebvre is professor of history at Trinity College. In her book, Imperial Wine, How the British Empire Made Wine's New World, she looks at how we can't understand the commodity production of the wines found so abundantly in supermarkets in the US and the UK, without understanding the centrality of empire. That book is published by UC Press. Let's start with this, Jennifer. How significant is the contribution of the former British colonies, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand, to the global wine market today, especially for the UK?
Oh, I think they make a massive contribution. They are a significant chunk, like a sizable value of the market, but they also have very long-standing cultural links. And one of the things I try to address in the book is that this connection and this presence in the British market didn't suddenly appear in the 1980s, that there's actually a very long history of Australia and South Africa in particular sending their wines to Britain and British people consuming their wines.
Well, let's talk about then the origin story here. Why did British settlers elect to produce wine in seemingly far-flung places like New Zealand and Australia and South Africa?
Well, it's funny because not only do these seem like very far-flung places, they're far from Britain, but the most improbable part is that in this time period that we're talking about, the 17th through, say, early 20th centuries, Britain is not producing wine itself. Nowadays, in the 21st century, there is a small but growing high-quality wine industry in England. But at the time I'm talking about, when these wineries, when these vineyards are established, Britain is not producing wine itself. So we're talking about people from Britain who don't actually have any experience in producing wine. But I think they do it for two reasons, two intertwined reasons. And one of them has to do with trade and with the value of trade. So most well-to-do British people, affluent British people, consumed wine in the 18th and 19th centuries. And for those people who were establishing colonies, who were in charge, so ship captains, for example, who are leading the first fleet out to Australia, they consume wine and they expect to have access to wine. And one of the ideas is that if you can produce it locally, then you don't have to go to the hassle and the expense of importing it from someplace else. And you could even think about it as a kind of import substitution. So if British people are used to getting a lot of their wine from France, which is a major imperial rival, wouldn't it be better if Britain could just produce its own wine? Then it wouldn't be in the business of buying French wine and bringing it to Australia to supply it to people who live there. So that's one reason. It's about trade. And I think there's even a hope and an expectation that wine could be a cash crop, in the way that tobacco or cotton or wool functions in other parts of the British Empire. So wine is one of the things that people who are colonizing other parts of the world are hoping is going to be profitable and to help make these colonies into self-supporting parts of the empire, that they would actually be making money on their own, that they wouldn't be dependent on the so-called mother country. But I think there's another reason why wine was important. And that's this long link between wine and civilization. And the impression that British settlers had that wine was a civilized beverage. For example, that wealthy people drink wine, so perhaps their behavior can be attributed to wine, versus the working classes in Britain, say in the 18th century, who are known for their consumption of beer and hard spirits, and that's associated with certain types of antisocial behavior. So the classic would be Hogarth's Prince of Gin Lane, where you have working class people who are all drunk on gin and they're falling over themselves and doing terrible things. So the idea is that if you can just get a colony to make its own wine, to consume its own wine, you're actually civilizing that place. In the British colonial imagination, the lands that they conquered were seen as uncivilized. There was ignorance about the indigenous cultures that lived there. There was a dismissiveness of those cultures, and a sense that British people were going to these new lands to make something of them, to civilize them, to improve them, and that by planting vineyards and making wine, it would be a very palpable, tangible example of how they were improving those lands.
Obviously, as part of a settler colonial project, which you emphasize is crucial to the establishment of so-called New World wines, that the wines of the colonies were produced through dispossession, including the land that the grapes were cultivated on, obviously, was taken and dispossessed. If you were to speak very generally, how would you say that dispossession differed among the colonies in South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand?
So I think there are a lot of similarities in the colonization of South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. And dispossession means that people who had access to land lose access to use that land in a way that's meaningful to them. And in many cases, British settlers didn't understand that you had itinerant people who were using land, for example, for hunting. And they mistook that to mean that the land wasn't occupied and that it therefore belonged to no one. So they didn't understand that there was a broader sense of land use, which it didn't fit a European model of land ownership because it didn't look like settled agriculture. So that's a similarity that you get across these three places. I think there are different degrees to which the British feel that Indigenous people are people they have to reckon with on, say, a diplomatic level. And I think the best case of that is in New Zealand, Aotearoa, New Zealand, where I write about the Treaty of Waitangi, which in many ways is a notorious document, but on one hand shows that the British realized they had to take Maori land claims, Maori presence seriously, that the Maori people were a formidable opponent in the contest over land. So it seems weird to, in some ways, see a document or a series of documents, which is the Treaty of Waitangi. It seems weird to see that as somehow a sign of respect for Indigenous people, because ultimately it led to further Maori land loss and cultural loss. But in some degree it was, whereas in Australia and South Africa, there was no real attempt to work with Indigenous people to define legally what their claims to land were.
Well, let me ask you about who worked on these vineyards and in the production of wine in the British colonies. Let's start with South Africa. Who was put to work in wine production and under what conditions?
So when we talk about labor in wine production, we are always at the mercy of our historical sources. And I think sometimes there's a frustration with historians, like, well, just go look it up. And we don't always have the sources that we would like to be able to find the answers to these questions. What we do know in South Africa, when I say that, I mean that we don't necessarily have a general database or government collection of wide-scale labor statistics that give us a lot of information about workers. But what we can say for South Africa is that there was widespread use of slavery enslaved people in wine vineyards from the 17th through the 19th century. And these are different groups of people. So some of them are indigenous San people, people who had whose ancestors had lived in this region for a very, very long time. Some of them were what become known as colored people, who are people of some kind of mixed racial ancestry. And some of them are actually imported enslaved people who are brought from other Dutch colonial possessions, in particular modern-day Indonesia, and also other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So it's a real mix of people working in this agricultural setting. But we do know that slavery was integral to wine production in colonial South Africa, that wine producers really guarded the right to keep slaves. They wrote public addresses to legislatures to ensure that they had the right to continue to hold slaves and that they could not have produced wine without slavery. So that was really important to the wine economy up into the 19th century. When slavery is eventually, you know, South Africa becomes a British possession, slavery is eventually abolished in 1833 in British territories. But in practice, you know, as we see, for example, with the end of slavery in the American South, that doesn't necessarily have a material improvement in the working conditions of people who worked in wine farms. Meaning, for example, that sometimes they went from being enslaved to essentially being indentured or having no means to actually move with their labor, so they were stuck. One of the ways that wine owners did this in South Africa was by using what's called the DOP or the TOT system, which is where workers are actually paid all or partly in alcohol. And this does a few different things that are really nefarious. One is it means that workers don't have ready cash, so they can't pick up and move to find other employment, or at least not very easily. Another thing it does is it starts people into often a cycle of alcoholism, which also impairs them in their ability to go and find other, better, more equitable work. And it plays into a European stereotype that we have to be really tough with our workers. We can't let them go someplace else because, as you can see, they're always drunk and they're not trustworthy. When, of course, this has been created by the very working conditions that Europeans imposed on these indigenous workers.
Right, and of course, the story in South Africa continues through apartheid, but let's just staying with the earlier years of colonial, British colonial wine production. Who was the labor force in Australia and New Zealand, and under what conditions did those workers work, as far as we can tell?
As far as I can tell, from having looked at the records of different vineyards and also looking at the records that were compiled by the colonial state and then later in the 20th century by the independent dominions of Australia and New Zealand, we are looking at mostly but not entirely people of European descent who are working in vineyards and in wineries. And a lot of this would have been seasonal labor. So this is part of the appeal of creating wine as a form of mixed agriculture, is the idea that it was a lot of seasonal work. So you have pruning in the winter, you have to also, you know, look after your plants in the spring and summer, but then there's a big harvest period and winemaking that happens in the autumn, and that's labor intensive. So you can have people who are working in other types of agriculture who are brought on for a few weeks as workers during the busy harvest period. And the records that I've looked at show that there are other local people, often whole families, who would sign on to do this kind of seasonal work for a local wine farmer. So it's a different situation in that these people are mostly free with their labor and they are probably choosing to do this on a temporary or seasonal basis. One of the complaints that people in Australia had who made wine and also in other agricultural areas was the high price of labor, that they had to pay these European men good wages, that was expected. And because it was hard to find cheap labor, there were various schemes suggested at various points in the 19th century, well, maybe we should import people from a different part of the world because we can get away with paying them less. But for the most part, I'm seeing European workers who make decent wages, and that is one of the reasons why Australia feels it's not competitive in the international wine market, because its wine is expensive to produce.
I'm speaking with historian Jennifer Regan Lefebvre about her book, Imperial Wine, How the British Empire Made Wine's New World. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then in those earlier years of the colonial production of wine as part of the British Empire, how did these producers do? I mean, on the one hand, you've mentioned that at that time, the market for wine in Britain was for the upper classes, which, you know, would be a more limited market. And you were mentioning variability in the cost of labor. How did these colonial wine producers, what were their success in establishing themselves as wine producers for this market in the UK?
It's a really interesting question because I think it depends how you measure success. So one of the things I found in the course of my research and I've tried to show in the book is that we have this impression that, let's take the 19th century, Britain in the 1800s, we have this impression that only really wealthy people drank wine and that everybody else, you know, 80% of the population drinks beer and spirits. And what I have found is that this is not entirely true, which is that fine wine consumption was limited to the wealthiest people, and that the wealthier you were, the more likely you were to drink wine. But that actually, wines from the British Empire, colonial wines, got a foothold in the British market by being cheap and accessible and consistent with some kind of vague idea of imperial patriotism, a kind of, you know, buy British Empire goods idea. And as a result, they are marketed towards probably the middle classes and the upper working classes, and probably as an occasional treat, not necessarily as something you'd have every single day. And South African wines in particular are just as popular in terms of exports as French wines in the middle of the 19th century. And that was really surprising to me because what I'd always read was, oh, you know, 19th century Britain, they love their French wine. French wine was fancy. Only wealthy people drank it. But if you look closer, you actually see that ordinary people are drinking South African wine. And it shows up in lots of different types of archival sources. I mean, I find it in newspaper advertisements, I find it in the records of shippers and importers, and I find it in the records of people who produce wine in South Africa and what they thought about the market. As for Australia, it's clear that the people who produced wine in the 19th century in Australia had ambitions of shipping their wine to other places in the British Empire. So back to the United Kingdom itself, but also shipping it to places like India, where you have a small British residential community that wants to get wine and that would prefer to get it more cheaply than having it sent all the way from France. So there are some markets there, and I have evidence of wine producers shipping their wines to those destinations, but it's not a huge amount. So most of the wine produced in 19th century Australia is probably being consumed in Australia. And in fact, probably being consumed in the region of Australia where it was created. Because before Australia became a single federation, there were actually tariffs amongst the different colonies. So it's a really interesting question because on the one hand, I can say that absolutely imperial wines, colonial wines have a very long history in the British market, much longer than most of us historians had recognized. But on the other hand, I can say that Australian and South African producers were never as successful as they wanted to be, as they desired to be in the 19th century, in selling their wines back to Britain.
Well, how did those wine producers in places like Australia and South Africa foster or attempt to foster the growth of the wine market back in Britain that you mentioned?
So they generally worked with importers, and there were a few British importers who specialized in wines from Australia and South Africa, who clearly thought that this was a kind of gap in the market, and that Australia and South Africa were growing producers, and that they could put themselves out there as the most important purveyors of these slightly exotic wines, but also affordable wines. And those importers had to maintain close relationships with producers in Australia to the extent that they could, given that they were, you know, 12,000 nautical miles apart. So one of the major importers that I looked at was a man named Burgoyne, who sent out agents to Australia who would then travel around and visit various vineyards and get to know the producers, taste their wines, bring back samples to Great Britain, and then it would all happen through correspondence, that there would be orders from Australia, and they would then be promoted in Britain. And I can see that wine importers, especially Burgoyne, were early adopters of various forms of advertising, visual advertising, for example, in public transportation. So if you look around 1900 at images from omnibuses, so public buses and trams, and also tube or subway stations in London, you see ads for Burgoyne's colonial wines, Burgoyne's Australian wines, Burgoyne's South African wines, advertising to people these goods from Empire. So they were quite savvy, and they also used things like trade shows. There were a number of imperial exhibitions that London put on in the second half of the 19th century to showcase kind of the glories of British imperialism and all the goods and people that came from different parts of the empire. And they used these as opportunities to get their wines before the public, to have tasting booths, to show different types of wine, to speak to customers about what these wines were like and why they should try them. So it was a multi-pronged strategy, and it was really a long game that they were playing. There was a lot of time and effort that went into trying to build up this industry in Britain.
What power did imperial sentiment have in wooing people in the UK to try wines from the British colonies? And to what degree did the appeal to empire end up trumping things like the prestige, say, of wine from France?
I think imperial sentiment was really important in promoting, advertising, and ultimately selling wines from British colonies. I think we have to imagine consumers as being confronted by choices, and considering the cost of the wine, the price, and also the meaning that it would have when it was served. So one thing that's really interesting about wine as a commodity is that we put so much value on it beyond its intrinsic material value. And wine has been associated with so many different things. You know, something that really amused me was in the lead up to the 2020 election in the United States, there was a Democratic candidate who had apparently done a fundraiser in a wine cave. You know, it's kind of a shocker, a wine cave, because people who have wine caves are rich and they are out of touch. And wine was clearly the stand-in for luxury and privilege and affluence, which some people found very off-putting. So in the same way, well, actually an opposite way, is if you look at the way wine is perceived in some discussions of, say, the 20th century French countryside, you know, wine is about the humble worker who farms his land and who gives wine to his family, and it's about the countryside and it's about patrimony. So wine can be all these different things, but it's very rarely sold as being free from meaning. So I think for a consumer to make a choice to buy Australian wine, let's say in the, 1880s, they're considering the price, but they're also considering, what does this mean? And people often want to know, well, was this wine in the 19th century, was it any good? Like, was it actually drinkable? Was Australian wine terrible? And there are lots of, you know, methodological reasons why it's very hard to say. But there's a lot of evidence why it might not have been as good as French wine. And some of that is just the logistics of shipping. We're talking about a product that was being sent in a ship's hold across the seas, not temperature controlled. These are not great conditions for wine. So there's reason to believe that the Australian wine is not going to sell because it tastes best. So why is it going to sell? Well, it's going to sell because it's cheaper. What if it's the same French cost as French wine? Why would you buy Australian wine instead of French wine? Well, that's where I think imperial sentiment plays into it, that a consumer, especially a middle-class consumer who might be a little bit nervous about buying wine because they have less exposure to it, might say, oh, I'm going to buy the imperial wine instead of the French wine because it feels good to support Britishness and the empire.
What impact did the dislocations of World War I have on the production and consumption of colonial wines?
World War I, I think, was an important turning point for colonial wines. For a few reasons. One is that you have the temporary disruption to European wine production. So if in 1914 the most popular wines in Britain are from France and Germany, well, Germany goes to war with Britain. And much of that fighting on the Western Front is in Eastern France, and some of that is very, very close to vineyards. You also have the loss of labor. You have a lot of young French people, men and women, mostly men, but women too, who would normally be working in vineyards, who are temporarily displaced as a result of the war. Either they've gone to fight or to drive ambulances or whatever. So that means that European production is down, and initially that's a nice boost to colonial wine production, or at least to colonial wine sales, because they're able to fill a void in the British market. And at a time when patriotism and a sense of imperial unity is really put at a premium, I think that imperial sentiment also plays into the sales of colonial wines. So at a time when Britain is trying to rally its colonies to produce troops, to contribute to the war effort, it feels good to some consumers to buy an imperial wine and to show that support in return. Obviously, the First World War creates an economic contraction in most wine-producing countries, and Australia is affected by that too, so is New Zealand. So in some ways, trade takes a dip by the end of the war, but it actually gives them an initial little boost. But then the next big boost really happens in the 1920s, and that's when you have a change in British tariffs in an attempt to try to promote buy empire goods. And they reduce the tariffs, the British do, reduce tariffs on colonial wines to make them more attractive, along with loads of other foodstuffs and goods from across the British Empire. And that's when we actually see a peak in the early 20th century in the market share of colonial wines. So more than ever, people are drinking Australian and South African wines in the late 1920s.
Was there any shift in the 1920s or in the post-World War I period to how working class and poor people were seen as wine consumers? I ask because wars are contradictory. They both can lead to greater control of society, but then afterwards, often there's a pressure to democratize, right? Because you've asked people to make all sorts of sacrifices. Did that have any ramifications in terms of lower class wine consumption?
I think it may have, and I think another thing I would point out are women entering the workforce and being seen as more independent consumers. So World War I, as you say, has a twofold impact on British society. On the one hand, rationing happens during the war. There are lots of social commitments that the state takes on after the war. It recognizes that it has all these young people coming back who are wounded. It pays, it needs to pay pensions to the families of people who died. It also needs to support soldiers. So there's a sort of a new level of comfort with state intervention in the economy. And there also is, as you say, a drive towards democratization. So it's in 1918, largely as the result of the war, that finally all men over the all adult men get the vote, can participate in democracy, and some women finally get. All women get the vote in 1928, so it's a two-stage process. But there's a big push towards democratization that happens as a result of the war. When I was looking at the records of various wine cellars and wine importers, I found that indeed in the 1920s there are wine importers and cellars. Often they're the same thing. You have an importer who has their own shop in working class neighborhoods. I found a lot of. I was looking at mostly London-based sources. And that they are selling mostly empire wines to a working class population. And they're often selling them in very large containers, sort of like the equivalent of a 3 liter jug, suggesting that these are party wines, that there's a social aspect to this. So I think there might be a democratization of consumption in the 1920s and 30s that we see with wine, that we see more people feeling like they can buy wine, that they can buy their own wine. That they don't need to be, led through the process by an expert. So there's perhaps a democratization of consumption as well.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with historian Jennifer Regan Lefebvre about her book, which is published by UC Press, Imperial Wine: How the British Empire Made Wine's New World. She's professor of history at Trinity College. and her other books include Cosmopolitan Nationalism in the Victorian Empire. Well, we were just talking about the effects of World War I on the market and production and trade of wine in the British colonies. How about World War II? Were the effects similar in terms of dislocation or different?
I would say that the effects of World War II were similar in terms of dislocation. There's another really important player that has emerged by now that's affecting the British market, which is Algeria. So Algeria is a really interesting case. It's a French colonial wine producer. So I think a lot of the arguments I make about Australia and South Africa apply to Algeria in the French context as well. And Algeria was one of the world's largest wine producers in the mid-20th century up until Algerian independence in the 1960s. And initially, in the start of World War II, I see the same trend that I noticed with World War I, that there's a little boost to Australian and South African production. But then it just becomes harder over the course of the war to get that wine, to actually get it from Australia shipped to Britain, because shipping has been affected by the war. The merchant marines are doing less work. It's hard to get boats through. There are boats that are, you know, attacked, and the cargo is lost, and so on. So it's easier to get Algerian wine. So in some ways, that's the Algerian wine that benefits the most from the war on the British market. And one of the fun things I found when I was looking at this was the records of King's College Cambridge, which is a college where I used to work at the University of Cambridge in England, which was really an elite space. And I see during World War II that basically the professors are continuing to drink down the reserves they had in the cellar. So they're continuing to drink mostly French wine, mostly Burgundy, Champagne, bit of Bordeaux, and even some German wines. But the students and the younger professors are drinking Algerian wine, Australian wine, South African wine, and not just still table wines, but also port and sherry style wines, which were really popular as drinks at the time. So you can see how people's tastes are changing, or they're being forced to change their tastes based on what's available. And what's interesting too is that after World War II, the market doesn't return to normal immediately. And one of the reasons is, of course, that it takes a few years to make really good wine. So if you have a vineyard that has been semi-abandoned for 5 years or 6 years because there's been a war on, and the war ends, well, maybe those troops come home and they're able to return to their lives as vineyard workers and winemakers. It still can take 2 or 3 years for them to get that vineyard and that winery back up and running and produce wine that's ready to be drunk. So this Australian and South African and Algerian advantage in the British market stays through the 1940s. And it's not really until the 1950s that you see France and Germany making a decent comeback in the British market.
I haven't really asked you about this, but as we're taking things up to the post-war period, but really more broadly in the 20th century, how important were the home markets for wine demand in the places that produced wine? You had mentioned in the early days of wine production in the British Empire that local or regional drinkers would be the destination for wine produced there, much of it. What happened in the 20th century with those home markets?
Those home markets continued to be very important through the 20th century. There was a perception with South African wine that there were very few exports, actually, in the 20th century. And this is a narrative that I challenged. I didn't expect to go about challenging it, but when I was looking at all the data, and I looked at a lot of export data, I was realizing that about half of the declared wine produced in South Africa was going overseas. Almost, one of the biggest export markets was Britain, but there were also a number of other imperial markets where South African wine was going. And this surprised me quite a bit. So that means that half of it, though, is still staying in South Africa and being consumed locally, or at least it's not being exported by ship. So with the data that we have, sometimes we're piecing stuff together and we don't have a source that just tells us exactly how much wine went to a certain place. We often have to figure this out by looking at lots of different kinds of data sets and then comparing them. It can be quite tedious. But so that's my impression. For Australia, I don't know if it approached 50%. I think it was less than that that was exported. So the home market is still really important. And Australian and South African wines start to fade out of favor in Britain in the 1960s and 1970s. There's a turn towards other types of European wines, so not just French and German, but also Bulgarian wines, Yugoslavian wines, Italian wines. Those become popular, and the South African and Australian wines become less popular. I think that is just a matter of taste rather than any particular market condition that's establishing that.
Yeah, well, with, of course, South African wines were produced during much of this period up into the early 90s under apartheid. But it doesn't sound like that had a significant impact on the consumption of South African wines, even though there were international calls for boycotts. Would that be fair to say?
That is absolutely fair to say. You know, with I think many historians, we tend to focus on studying change. So I had read plenty about the anti-apartheid movement in Britain, because these are interesting people and it's a really important movement. We all know now that apartheid was a horrific system. So it's interesting to study the anti-apartheid movement. So in some ways I had the impression when I started looking at this problem that South African wine was going to be prominent in discussions in anti-apartheid, and that the British public was going to be largely on board with this. And I was surprised to find that that wasn't really the case. So even if South African wine is very important to the South African wine industry, it's an important industry in South Africa, it's nothing compared to exports of clothing or certain kinds of fruit like oranges. So you see a lot more emphasis in the British anti-apartheid movement on boycotting those goods. And I saw very few references to boycotting South African wine, which surprised me. And I even found that there were specialist importers in Britain that continued to specialize in South African wine through the 1970s and 1980s. So it never really disappeared. And it seems to have flown under the radar of the anti-apartheid movement, probably because it was a smaller market.
You note that the wines from the former colonies were consumed at their highest rate, not during the heyday of the British Empire, but after decolonization. And yet you are also arguing that the connection to British Empire is fundamentally important. How do you reconcile that lag?
I think I reconcile it by showing that the 1960s and 1970s were kind of a blip, an aberration, an exception to a much longer history of trade. So here's one of the ways in which I approached researching this book. One of the questions that was driving me was I had read a lot of literature, especially from wine economics, that tried to understand how is it that Australian wine suddenly became so popular in Britain in the late 1980s. And I thought, well, that's a good question. But then I was also seeing on bottles of Australian wine, like, you know, we've proudly been producing this wine since the 1840s. And I thought, huh, this is interesting because apparently Australia was producing wine for a very long time, but it didn't actually do anything with it in terms of sending it abroad until the 1980s. What was going on in the meantime? And when I started looking into it, of course, what I found and what the book explores is that there is a very strong cultural connection there between British imperialism and Australian winemaking. And I think what's really interesting when we're talking about empire today and looking at what historians call the history of empire at home, how Britain was shaped by the experience of having an empire overseas, is that there's sometimes a tendency to try to distance contemporary Britain from its imperial past. Well, that was really nothing to do with us, or it was a very long time ago. And one of the things I'm trying to show in this book is that that's not the case when it comes to wine, that it's a much longer history. And I think this is even an interesting point if you're somebody who is looking at, you know, the wine industry today, you're thinking, wow, how is it that the Australians are doing so well in Britain? Well, it's because they've been selling there for almost 200 years. It's not just a recent phenomenon. So if you want to trace that, you can't just start in 1987. You have to go further back. So I think I'm trying to make some larger points about the role of empire in shaping modern Britain today and the historical consciousness that I would like consumers to have when they consider the origin of many of these foodstuffs.
Historian Jennifer Regan Lefebvre is my guest. We're discussing imperial wine, how the British Empire made wine's new world. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. Well, you were talking about that distance or proximity to the imperial past, this notion that that was another era that's behind us. Do you think that the appeal of former colonial wines for British consumers is partially due to a shifted notion of what former colonial wines conjure up? Or do you think that there's still a whiff of the imperial past that's part of the appeal?
That's a great question. I don't know if I would say it's a whiff of the imperial past. I think British people feel a degree of comfort with South African, Australian, and New Zealand culture. And that's because they have a long shared history, which, you know, at its origin was a colonial history. So I think people feel like Australian wine, for example, is fun and approachable because Australian people are laid back and fun. They like rugby. They like barbecues. They like backpacking. There have been very successful large schemes for young people in Britain and Australia to travel and to be guest workers for short periods of time. And for many British people, this was a rite of passage, you know, to go to Australia and to work for a while and, you know, enjoy surfing and sunshine and so on. But to understand how these things came about, we have to recognize it's because there was a colonial relationship between the two countries. So it's not quite the same as saying there is an appreciation for the imperial past, but I think there should be a recognition of where that relationship comes from and how it was shaped and how it continues to, you know, have an impact on domestic issues in Australia today, for example, with Indigenous land rights or Indigenous water rights.
Has there been an equivalent marketing of, say, Australian wine to people in Britain based not on a kind of iconography of the imperial past, but this kind of Crocodile Dundee version of Australia, which is, you know, very tourist friendly?
I mean, in the 1980s, in the late 1980s, Australian culture was having a real moment in British life. Crocodile Dundee, I mean, it gets mentioned in the book, which was a real achievement for me as an academic historian. I never thought I would do that, mention Crocodile Dundee. or the long-running Australian soap opera Neighbours, which was also hugely popular in the late 1980s. Is it a coincidence that it was the 200th anniversary of the arrival of the first fleet of British convicts to Australia? I don't think so. I think it was a moment to capitalize on that sense of shared history. If you look at the advertising for wine for Marks and Spencer, for example, which is one of the major wine cellars in Britain and a British cultural institution, it's a chain of department stores that has food halls. So they have a small grocery store operation in most of their stores, and they also sell clothing and so on. And they're iconic in Britain. They had celebrations, and I've looked at the literature, the material relating to this, of the 200th anniversary of the establishment of Australia with a whole series of new Australian wines available to consumers. So they absolutely cashed in on this in the late 1980s. I think that would not go down well. I think that would can be considered in poor taste today, because I think as a whole, I think, you know, British and Australian society are more cognizant of many of the evils of imperialism and are less likely to say, this is great, we should celebrate this. But it was very powerful 35 years ago.
Well, obviously, wine production from the former British colonies is still going strong and rooted in this history, as you're arguing, an imperial history. And I wonder if you could comment on the conditions under which this wine is made today. South Africa is no longer a British colony, nor is Australia or New Zealand, and yet these histories are part of the histories of these countries. When we think about questions of land rights and labor, what do these wine industries look like in these countries now?
This takes me a little bit outside of my comfort zone as a historian, but it's an absolutely fair question. And Australia has still tries to recruit laborers to rural areas, and that is sometimes a struggle. They have various schemes to recruit temporary workers, you know, students, for example, who are taking a gap year in their studies to come and work on various kinds of farms, including wine farms. So I think we can probably say that the working conditions in Australia and New Zealand are reasonable and good. South Africa is a different question. It's interesting. One of my big disappointments in writing this book is that I was not able to go to South Africa. You know, it took a while to find funding. Then I had some personal reasons why I couldn't travel. And then the pandemic started. And poor South Africa has kind of been patient zero for the COVID-19 pandemic. So for a while, it was not practicable for me to travel there, because what I really wanted to do was to visit some of these vineyards myself and to try to talk to them. There's one vineyard I write about in particular that actually has a museum of slavery that addresses the past of the vineyard and recognizes, and I think tries to sort of reason with its past of using enslaved labor. But this same vineyard has also been under scrutiny and has come under criticism for not doing more to address the land rights of workers and the labor conditions. So I think it's a very complicated question. I mean, there have been a lot of schemes in South Africa that fall under black economic empowerment, which are to try to get black citizens to rise through the ranks of various industries, including in wine, where they are absolutely underrepresented at the level of owning wineries or running wineries. But it's not clear yet how successful they have been. These are very long-term projects.
Let me end by asking you about the shift that you've described, but I wonder if you could talk about it in a bit more detail, in British culture around not simply colonial wines or former colonial wines at this point, but of wine consumption. As you've mentioned, wine carries all sorts of connotations. It's a huge amount of class baggage. Imagine that baggage remains in the UK. And yet at the same time, wine has become consumed at a much greater volume by people of all social classes. What exactly took place to allow that to happen?
One of the main reasons seems to be the role of supermarkets in carrying wine, selling wine, and offering incredible deals on wine. You know, three bottles for £15, you know, which is roughly equivalent of, oh, I don't know. I mean, it depends. It's going to vary between $15 and $25. So really good bargains on wine that make it just very affordable and accessible. And the format also of selling wines in supermarkets means that you take away that level of expertise that you get with somebody working in a wine shop, but you also take away that level of scrutiny. Many people find it, even me sometimes, a little intimidating to walk into a wine shop and somebody approaches you and says, hi, what are you looking for? What are you interested in? And you think, oh, I don't know, wine? So the supermarket takes that away because you can just browse at your leisure and choose what you want. So many scholars attribute the rise of the supermarket to really changing wine buying habits. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. I do not think, on the other hand, that the supermarket is what led to the rise of Australian wine first entering the British market. That's a different kind of argument. But certainly in changing how people buy their wine and how much of it they buy, I think the supermarkets have a big role. There are also a lot of what are called high street chains, meaning franchises or chains of wine shops that you find on the British main street in a village or town or city. So there's a lot of visibility of wine shops, and they're chains, so they have a kind of brand and market recognition that you don't get in a sort of individual mom and pop wine shop or liquor store. And I think a third thing is that wine is really present, especially since the late 1980s, in the British press. It's very, very common for British newspapers to have a weekly wine column. Obviously, papers like The Times, The Financial Times, The Guardian have wine writers on staff. Those are big papers, but also smaller regional papers often have a weekly wine column, and it's very common to see, you know, great bargains under £10, you know, best bottles for Christmas, the best cheap rosés for the summer, this kind of feature. So there's a lot of journalism and effort around marketing cheaper wines, accessible wines, affordable wines to the British public. So I think that's a lot to do with it. And the other thing is that pubs carry wine. You know, pubs used to be largely associated with beer, and any pub you walk into in Britain now, you're going to find wine too, and it's probably going to be Australian.
With the press, what do you think is behind the motivation to have these columns about wine? Is this something that is actively fostered or subsidized in some way by the wine industry? Why does that seem to be an important role for journalism in the UK?
That's a really great question. I'm not aware that it is subsidized in any way. I think 20th century Britain has been blessed with some incredible writing talent of people who are really passionate about wine. So I think the readability of these columns has been really important. So people like Jancis Robinson, Hugh Johnson, Tim Atkins, you know, they are really passionate about wine. They're really talented journalists, and people look forward to reading their columns. So I think that's part of it. I think there was a thirst for this information, if you pardon the pun. I think these columns persist because they seem to work, that people actually read them, they respond to them, they write in about them, and that you can see a difference in sales as a result of these columns. So I don't think there's any kind of, sort of invisible hand of the wine industry that's guiding all of this. I think it's a series of, just a nice combination of particular talent and interest. I mean, newspapers, as a historian, I would say newspapers both shape and reflect public interest. They have a kind of dual role. If they're publishing information that no one wants to read, they're not going to be successful. But obviously, we get a lot of information from the press, and it helps shape our opinions and our views and what we think is normal. Having wine columns in a newspaper normalizes wine consumption. And I think that's had a really big impact.
Jennifer Regan Lefebvre, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely my pleasure, Sasha. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking about the book Imperial Wine, How the British Empire Made Wine's New World. That's published by University of California Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. Jennifer Regan Lefebvre is professor of history at Trinity College, and her other books include Cosmopolitan Nationalism in the Victorian Empire. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.